Chapter 139. The human nature unto which I felt that I belonged, and reverenced with love, was not a punctual presence, but a spirit diffused through time and space, with aid derived of evidence from monuments, erect, prostrate, or leaning toward their common rest in earth, the widely scattered wreck sublime of vanished nations. Wordsworth. The Prelude. Sir Hugo carried out his plan of spending part of the autumn at Diplo, and by the beginning of October his presence was spreading some cheerfulness in the neighborhood, among all ranks and persons concerned, from the stately home of Brackenshaw and Quetcham to the respectable shop parlors in Wanchester. For Sir Hugo was a man who liked to show himself and be affable, a liberal of good lineage, who confided entirely in reform was not likely to make any serious difference in English habits of feeling, one of which undoubtedly is the liking to behold society well fenced and adorned with hereditary rank. Hence he made Diplo a most agreeable house, extending his invitations to old Wanchester solicitors and young village curates, but also taking some care in the combination of the guests, and not feeding all the common poultry together, so that they should think their meal no particular compliment. Easy-going Lord Brackenshaw, for example, would not mind meeting Robinson the attorney, but Robinson would have been naturally piqued if he had been asked to meet a set of people who passed for his equals. On all these points Sir Hugo was well informed enough at once to gain popularity for himself and give pleasure to others, two results which eminently suited his disposition. The rector of Pennicott now found a reception at Diplo very different from the haughty tolerance he had undergone during the reign of Grandcourt. It was not that the baronet liked Mr. Gaskin. It was that he desired to keep up a marked relation of friendliness with him on account of Mrs. Grandcourt, for whom Sir Hugo's chivalry had become more and more engaged. Why? The chief reason was one, that he could not fully communicate, even to Lady Malinger, for he would not tell what he thought one woman's secret to another, even though the other was his wife, which shows that his chivalry included a rare reticence. Deronda, after he had become engaged to Mira, felt it right to make a full statement of his position and purposes to Sir Hugo, and he chose to make it by letter. He had more than a presentiment that his fatherly friend would feel some dissatisfaction, if not pain, at this turn of his destiny. In reading unwelcome news, instead of hearing it, there is the advantage that one avoids a hasty expression of impatience which may afterward be repented of. Deronda dreaded that verbal collision which makes otherwise pardonable feeling lastingly offensive. And Sir Hugo, though not altogether surprised, was thoroughly vexed. His immediate resource was to take the letter to Lady Malinger, who would be sure to express an astonishment which her husband could argue against as unreasonable, and in this way divide the stress of his discontent. And in fact, when she showed herself astonished and distressed that all Daniel's wonderful talents, and the comfort of having him in the house, should have ended in his going mad in this way about the Jews, the baronet could say, "Oh, nonsense, my dear. Depend upon it, Dan will not make a fool of himself. He has large notions about Judaism, political views which you can't understand. No fear but Dan will keep himself head uppermost." But with regard to the prospective marriage, she afforded him no counter-irritant. The gentle lady observed, without rancor, that as he had little dreamed of what was coming when as he had Mira to sing at her musical party and give lessons to Amable. After some hesitation, indeed, she confessed it had passed through her mind that after a proper time Daniel might marry Mrs. Grandcourt, because it seemed so remarkable that she should be at Genoa just at that time, and although she herself was not fond of widows, she could not help thinking that such a marriage would have been better than his going altogether with the Jews. But Sir Hugo was so strongly of the same opinion that he could not correct it as a feminine mistake, and his ill humor at the disproof of his disagreeable conclusions on behalf of Gwendolyn was left without vent. He desired Lady Malinger not to breathe a word about the affair till further notice, saying to himself, If it is an unkind cut to the poor thing, meaning Gwendolyn, the longer she is without knowing it, the better, in her present nervous state. And she will best learn it from Dan himself. Sir Hugo's conjectures had worked so industriously with his knowledge, that he fancied himself well informed concerning the whole situation. Meanwhile, his residence with his family at Diplo enabled him to continue his fatherly attentions to Gwendolyn. And indeed, Lady Malinger, notwithstanding her small liking for widows, was quite willing to second him. The plan of removal to Offenden had been carried out, and Gwendolyn, in settling there, maintained a calm beyond her mother's hopes. She was experiencing some of that peaceful melancholy which comes from the renunciation of demands for self, and from taking the ordinary good of existence, and especially kindness, even from a dog, as a gift above expectation. Does one who has been all but lost in a pit of darkness complain of the sweet air and the daylight? There is a way of looking at our life daily as an escape, and taking the quiet return of morn and evening still more the star-like outglowing of some pure fellow feeling, some generous impulse breaking our inward darkness as a salvation, that reconciles us to hardship. Those who have a self-knowledge prompting such self-accusation as Hamlet's, can understand this habitual feeling of rescue. And it was felt by Gwendolyn as she lived through and through again the terrible history of her temptations, from their first form of illusory self-pleasing, when she struggled away from the hold of conscience, to their latest form of an urgent hatred dragging her toward its satisfaction, while she prayed and cried for the help of that conscience which she had once forsaken. She was now dwelling on every word of Deronda's, that pointed to her past deliverance from the worst evil in herself, and the worst infliction of it on others, and on every word, that carried a force to resist self-despair. But she was also upborne by the prospect of soon seeing him again. She did not imagine him otherwise than always within her reach, her supreme need of him blinding her to the separateness of his life, the whole scene of which she filled with his relation to her no unique preoccupation of Gwendolyn's, for we are all apt to fall into this passionate egoism of imagination, not only toward our fellow men, but toward God. And the future which she turned her face to with a willing step, was one where she would be continually assimilating herself to some type that he would hold before her. Had he not first risen on her vision as a corrective presence which he had recognized in the beginning with resentment, and at last with entire love and trust? She could not spontaneously think of an end to that reliance, which had become to her imagination like the firmness of the earth, the only condition of her walking. And Deronda was not long before he came to Diplo, which was a more convenient distance from town than the abbey. He had wished to carry out a plan for taking Ezra and Mira to a mild spot on the coast, while he prepared another home which Mira might enter as his bride, and where they might unitedly watch over her brother. But Ezra begged not to be removed, unless it were to go with them to the east. All outward solicitations were becoming more and more of a burden to him, but his mind dwelt on the possibility of this voyage with a visionary joy. Deronda, in his preparations for the marriage, which he hoped might not be deferred beyond a couple of months, wished to have fuller consultation as to his resources and affairs generally with Sir Hugo, and here was a reason for not delaying his visit to Diplo. But he thought quite as much of another reason his promise to Gwendolyn. The sense of blessedness in his own lot had yet an aching anxiety at his heart. This may be held paradoxical, for the beloved lover is always called happy, and happiness is considered as a well-fleshed indifference to sorrow outside it. But human experience is usually paradoxical, if that means incongruous with the phrases of current talk or even current philosophy. It was no treason to Mira, but a part of that full nature which made his love for her the more worthy, that his joy in her could hold by its side the care for another. For what is love itself, for the one we love best? An enfolding of immeasurable cares which yet are better than any joys outside our love. Deronda came twice to Diplo, and saw Gwendolyn twice, and Eddie went back to town without having told her anything about the change in his lot and prospects. He blamed himself, but in all momentous communication likely to give pain we feel dependent on some preparatory turn of words or associations, some agreement of the other's mood with the probable effect of what we have to impart. In the first interview Gwendolyn was so absorbed in what else he had to say to him, so full of questions which he must answer, about the arrangement of her life, what she could do to make herself less ignorant, how she could be kindest to everybody, and make amends for her selfishness and try to be rid of it, that Deronda utterly shrank from waiving her immediate wants in order to speak of himself, nay, from inflicting a wound on her in these moments, when she was leaning on him for help in her path. In the second interview, when he went with new resolve to command the conversation into some preparatory track, he found her in a state of deep depression, overmastered by some distasteful, miserable memories which forced themselves on her as something more real and ample than any new material out of which she could mold her future. She cried hysterically, and said that he would always despise her. He could only seek words of soothing and encouragement. And when she gradually revived under them, with that pathetic look of renewed childlike interest which we see in eyes, where the lashes are still beaded with tears, it was impossible to lay another burden on her. But time went on, and he felt it a pressing duty to make the difficult disclosure. Gwendolyn, it was true, never recognized his having any affairs, and it had never even occurred to her to ask him why he happened to be at Genoa. But this unconsciousness of hers would make a sudden revelation of affairs that were determining his course in life all the heavier blow to her, and if he left the revelation to be made by different persons, she would feel that he had treated her with cruel inconsiderateness. He could not make the communication in writing. His tenderness could not bear to think of her reading his virtual farewell in solitude, and perhaps feeling his words full of a hard gladness for himself and indifference for her. He went down to Diplo again, feeling that every other peril was to be incurred, rather than that of returning and leaving her still in ignorance. On his third visit Deronda found Hans Meyrick installed with his easel at Diplo, beginning his picture of the three daughters sitting on a bank, in the Gainsborough style, and varying his work, by rambling to Pennicott, to sketch the village children and improve his acquaintance with the Gascons. Hans appeared to have recovered his vivacity, but Deronda detected some feigning in it, as we detect the artificiality of a lady's bloom from its being a little too high-toned, and steadily persistent, a fluctuating rouge not having yet appeared among the advertisements. Also, with all his grateful friendship and admiration for Deronda, Hans could not help a certain irritation against him, such as extremely incautious, open natures are apt to feel when the breaking of a friend's reserve discloses a state of things not merely unsuspected, but the reverse of what had been hoped and ingeniously conjectured. It is true that poor Hans had always cared, chiefly to confide in Deronda, and had been quite incurious as to any confidence that might have been given in return. But what outpourer of his own affairs is not tempted to think any hint of his friend's affairs is an egotistic irrelevance? That was no reason why it was not rather a sore reflection to Hans that while he had been all along naively opening his heart about Mira, Deronda had kept secret a feeling of rivalry which now revealed itself as the important determining fact. Moreover, it is always at their peril that our friends turn out to be something more than we were aware of. Hans must be excused for these promptings of bruised sensibility, since he had not allowed them to govern his substantial conduct. He had the consciousness of having done right by his fortunate friend, or, as he told himself, his medal had given a better ring than he would have sworn to beforehand. For Hans had always said that in point of virtue he was a dilettante, which meant that he was very fond of it in other people, but if he meddled with it himself he cut a poor figure. Perhaps in reward of his good behavior he gave his tongue the more freedom, and he was too fully possessed by the notion of Deronda's happiness to have a conception of what Lai was feeling about Gwendolyn, so that he spoke of her without hesitation. "When did you come down, Hans?" said Deronda, joining him in the grounds, where he was making a study of the requisite bank and trees. "Oh, 10 days ago, before the time Sir Hugo fixed. I ran down with Rex Gaskin, and stayed at the rectory a day or two. I'm up in all the gossip of these parts. I know the state of the wheelwright's interior, and have assisted at an infant school examination. Sister Anna, with a good upper lip, escorted me, else I should have been mobbed by 3 urchins and an idiot, because of my long hair and a general appearance which departs from the penicate type of the beautiful. Altogether, the village is idyllic. Its only fault is a dark curate with broad shoulders and broad trousers who ought to have gone into the heavy drapery line. The Gaskins are perfect besides being related to the Vandyck Duchess. I caught a glimpse of her in her black robes at a distance, though she doesn't show to visitors." "She was not staying at the rectory?" said Deronda. "No, but I was taken to Offenden to see the old house, and as a consequence I saw the Duchess's family. I suppose you have been there, and know all about them?"
"Yes, I have been there," said Deronda, quietly. "A fine old place. An excellent setting for a widow with romantic fortunes. And she seems to have had several romances. I think I have found out that there was one between her and my friend Rex."
"Not long before her marriage, then?" said Deronda, really interested, for they had only been a year at Offenden. "How came you to know anything of it?"
"Oh, not ignorant of what it is to be a miserable devil. I learned to gloat on the signs of misery in others. I found out that Rex never goes to Offenden, and has never seen the Duchess since she came back. And Miss Gaskin let fall something in our talk about charade acting, for I went through some of my nonsense to please the young one, something that proved to me that Rex was once hovering about his fair cousin close enough to get singed. I don't know what was her part in the affair. Perhaps the Duke came in and carried her off. That is always the way when an exceptionally worthy young man forms an attachment. I understand now why Gaskin talks of making the law his mistress and remaining a bachelor. But these are green resolves. Since the Duke did not get himself drowned for your sake, it may turn out to be for my friend Rex's sake. Who knows? Is it absolutely necessary that Mrs. Grandcourt should marry again?" said Deronda, ready to add that Hans's success in constructing her fortunes hitherto had not been enough to warrant a new attempt.
"You monster!" retorted Hans. "Do you want her to wear weeds for you all her life, burn herself in perpetual suttee, while you are alive and merry?"
Deronda could say nothing, but he looked so much annoyed that Hans turned the current of his chat, and when he was alone shrugged his shoulders a little over the thought that there really had been some stronger feeling between Deronda and the Duchess than Mira would like to know of. "Why didn't she fall in love with me?" thought Hans, laughing at himself. "She would have had no rivals. No woman ever wanted to discuss theology with me." No wonder that Deronda winced under that sort of joking with a whiplash. It touched sensibilities that were already quivering with the anticipation of witnessing some of that pain to which even Hans's light words seemed to give more reality. Any sort of recognition by another giving emphasis to the subject of our anxiety. And now he had come down with the firm resolve that he would not again evade the trial. The next day he rode to Offenden. He had sent word that he intended to call and to ask if Gwendolyn could receive him, and he found her awaiting him in the old drawing room where some chief crises of her life had happened. She seemed less sad than he had seen her since her husband's death. There was no smile on her face, but a placid self-possession, in contrast with the mood in which he had last found her. She was all the more alive to the sadness perceptible in Deronda, and they were no sooner seated yet a little distance opposite to her than she said, "You were afraid of coming to see me, because I was so full of grief and despair the last time. but I am not so today. I have been sorry ever since. I have been making it a reason why I should keep up my hope and be as cheerful as I can, because I would not give you any pain about me. There was an unwonted sweetness in Gwendolyn's tone and look as she uttered these words that seemed to Deronda to infuse the utmost cruelty into the task now laid upon him. But he felt obliged to make his answer a beginning of the task. I am in some trouble today, he said, looking at her rather mournfully, but it is because I have things to tell you which you will. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.